ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Our brains are mysterious organs. And one of the ways that scientists try to understand how they work is to look at how we change when our brains change. When people survive a stroke, for example, they may interpret the world around them differently. Their way of interacting with loved ones can change. And at the extreme end of the spectrum, strokes can leave the people closest to us almost like strangers. Since she was a kid, Margaret Moore has been fascinated with figuring out how things work. And her curiosity has led her to studying strokes and what they do to the way our brain works. It's thought that around 1 in 3 adults will have a stroke at some point. This statistic really hit home when Margaret was writing up her PhD at Oxford University. Margaret is now a researcher at the Queensland Brain Institute at the University of Queensland, and she's currently investigating how our brain's expectations of reality shape the way we experience it, what she calls a kind of predictive texting of the mind. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Your accent isn't Australian. Where did you grow up?
It is not. I grew up in Indiana in the US. A lot of corn, very small town, very flat. And I think it's one of those places where growing up, I did a lot of complaining about it. But now that I've moved out and seen a lot more of the world, it makes me really value it for being such a nice, cozy little place to grow up.
What bugged you most about it when you were a surly teenager?
Oh, I think I did the same thing that every teenager does, being like, oh, I want to go to the big city and experience the real world and see everything.
That part of America, is that tornadoes or
not?
Yes,
it is.
And what are your memories of that?
I am terrified of tornadoes. There were a couple of big ones that came through growing up. A small town next to me got leveled by one, I think, when I was like 15. So, yeah, they're scary.
And what was the drill when there was one on the way?
In theory, you are supposed to go into the basement, but not everyone has a basement, which is why it can get quite dangerous. And also, if you're from the Midwest, you think storms are cool and you'd rather go outside and look at it. So that can also cause problems.
How strict were your parents with you when there was a tornado on the way?
They were more relaxed than I was. I think I was a bit of an anxious kid and took it very seriously, and even when other people often didn't. So I have a memory of during my older brother's high school graduation party, there was a tornado warning, and I went to the basement, and I was the only one in the basement, and it was so stressful, but everyone got down eventually.
So it was a small town, mm-hmm. So small, in fact, that your own dad was your teacher
yes.
at high school.
Yes, he was.
What was that like?
It didn't seem weird to me, because I always grew up with it, knowing it was going to happen, and it was a small school, and he taught several different subjects, some of which I had to take, and some of which I wanted to take. So I had him as my world history teacher for a year. That was his favorite. But then he also taught psychology and sociology. So that was, strangely, one of the first places I got exposed to the kind of things I now spend my time working on.
And what was he like as a teacher?
He was a massive nerd, and you could tell that he just got so excited about the things that he really cared about. History was his core love, and he would teach it through movies. And so we would have students watch a movie set in a historical time period. So one of the ones I remember was like Valkyrie, which is set during World War II, and it's them trying to organize a plot to overthrow Hitler from the inside. He would have them watch movies like that and then critique them and look at what was real, what wasn't real, what was the historical context, and trying to understand it from that perspective. And that's something that kids, especially at that age, really loved, because it was an engaging way to learn history.
He sounds like a cool teacher.
Yeah.
What were you into subject-wise at school?
A lot of different things. I think I had no idea what I was interested in. And growing up, I didn't really understand that you could be a scientist. I thought, like, if you wanted to go down that route, I knew you could be a doctor, like a medical doctor. And I didn't really know about anything else. I really loved writing. I've always loved writing. And I just, like, English class was my favorite. And I didn't really like science that much, to be honest. And I think that it took me until I got into university to start realizing the bits that I loved about science. Instead of just memorizing things the way you do in high school, I loved learning about the things we don't know yet, and learning that, oh, we actually have no idea how the brain is working or how cells work or any of that. And that kind of uncertainty was what excited me.
You did find yourself trying to do some sort of home experiments of figuring things out outside of class. What preoccupied you in that sense, Margaret?
Oh, man. I think when I was in the sixth grade, I got a mood ring at a birthday party, and I became, like, fully fascinated with understanding how this mood ring worked. And I remember just, like, taking it through all these weird scenarios, like putting it underwater, like burying it, putting it in the freezer to try to figure out what made it work.
And can you reveal the mysterious secret?
Temperature makes a difference. Surprise, I don't think it's actually recording moods.
Outside of school, tell me about the holidays that you and your dad and your brothers would go on together, the trips.
Yeah, growing up in the US, you do quite a lot of road trips normally, because especially if you have a family, it's a reasonably cheap way to see a lot of the country. And my dad was a history teacher and really liked historical sites. And so when we would go on road trips, it would normally be centered around like a Civil War battlefield that he was interested in or a monument that he wanted to see, plus everything else in the area. So one of the ones I remember most clearly is we went out to the East Coast and the area on Boston. So we spent some time in Salem and we learned about the Salem witch trials. Then we went to Boston and learned about all the Revolutionary War things. And then we saw a baseball game. Lots of trips like that.
What would be on the car stereo when you were driving those long hours on the highway?
Very eclectic mix of things that are very nice. So my dad was really into old music that was old even for him. And so a lot of that was blues, Americana, and lots of like bluegrass. So his favorite artist was Merle Travis, who plays a lot of guitar in a very interesting style. So lots of those kind of things.
Could he play guitar himself?
Yes. So my dad was a teacher by day, blues guitarist by any other time he could fit it in. Whenever I was at home, I would wake up to him playing every morning. He would play on his lunch breaks at work. And later on, he got really interested in making lessons. And so he's got a whole like YouTube series where he explains to people how to play old school blues guitar.
It sounds like your dad was into just learning, full stop, whether it was about history or witches or baseball or guitar. Is that part of what he passed on to you?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think one of the things that he did that really tried to help us learn to love to learn too is that I think around once a year he would skip us all out of school, which was pretty ironic because he was also skipping school.
Were the authorities sort of suspicious that no one ever questioned it.
I think we were all doing okay enough that no one really worried when we just all vanished mysteriously. But he would take us out and we would go to a museum or do some kind of like fun learning thing. I grew up relatively near Chicago, so we would take a day drive to Chicago and go to one of their very many cool museums, like the Field Museum to look at like natural history stuff, or the Museum of Science and Industry is there as well. So lots of trips like that.
It's kind of nice to experience learning outside of just grades and school as well, isn't it? I mean, I guess it arms you in a different way to see learning as something internal rather than just about getting some external validation.
Yes. Yeah. I've always been motivated by just like seeing yourself understand things. It's very satisfying to understand how things work. And I think I always kind of prioritize that feeling first, and then just grades came after that.
So you were introduced to psychology, the study of psychology, first of all, by your father. Was it something you knew you wanted to pursue after you finished school?
In a way, so because I didn't know anything else, I thought I wanted to be like a therapist. And then it took a couple years of getting into that to realize like, oh, you could just do science. And that is a lot more what my skill set is for. This like figuring things out kind of mentality works a lot better for like numbers than people. No one really likes someone just to try to figure out what their problem is. You want more empathy than that. But figuring it out works well in science.
You headed over to the UK, to Oxford, to do a PhD and were working with stroke victims. Why was it people who'd experienced strokes that was the area you wanted to research on? What was interesting to you about that?
So stroke provides a really interesting test bed of pretty much every theory that neuroscience can put together. Because a lot of neuroscience methods, so things like fMRI, things like EEG, anything that's recording brain activity, what that does is it can tell you what brain processes and brain areas are involved in certain functions. But there's a difference between being involved in functions and being necessary for functions. And to know whether or not not something that's necessary. You need to see what happens when that part breaks. And stroke is a way to do that. And so in stroke, you have damage to the brain caused by loss of oxygen to certain cells. Cells die off, and then we have a way of trying to figure out what was that brain part doing. And also, too, a lot of cognitive neuroscience is built around making these very neat box and arrow diagrams of how you think certain processes work. And it's really important to find a way to test those. And so a lot of the work I did was saying, hey, there's this theory that says reading or spatial perception works in this specific way. If it works in that way, you would expect it to break in certain ways. So you would expect certain disorders, but not other disorders. And stroke is a way to test for that. So test if the predictions of these models work when things are broken, right, as well as when they're intact.
So the damaged brain can teach you how the functioning brain is working. So you mentioned that stroke is caused by a lack of oxygen in the brain. How does that happen? What causes that?
So there's a couple different ways to have a stroke. The most commons are have an ischemic stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke. In a hemorrhage, what happens is a blood vessel in your brain bursts, and that can happen from things like high blood pressure or otherwise weakening of the blood vessel. It bursts and blood goes into the brain. But what that means is that blood that went in the brain isn't getting to the cells it was supposed to go to, so those cells die from not having oxygen. The other way, which is more common, is an ischemic stroke, and in that, a blood vessel will get clogged. And so it's the same thing that happens like when you cross your legs for too long, then you're toes start feeling tingly. It's the same thing, but much, much worse. And then that feeling doesn't come back. And so its cells need oxygen to live. When that's deprived by something happening in the blood vessels, whatever areas of tissue that were being supplied by the blood vessels die off.
So what are the first outward signs that this is happening in someone's brain?
Best way to do it is FAST, which is face, arms, speech, and then time to call the hospital. So one of the most common signs is facial droop. So how the brain is laid out is that one side of the brain controls the opposite side of the body. When you have damage to those areas that control the opposite side of the body, you lose feeling or the ability to control them. And so people who've had a right hemisphere stroke might have drooping on their face on the left side. So if you suddenly become unable to move your face, that is a problem. That's the face bit. Arms is the same problem, but with your arms and the rest of your body. So if you suddenly have an inability to move one arm or control it properly and it's just on one side, that is a key sign of stroke. Speech is if you have a stroke on the left side of the brain, it's going to affect the areas that control language. So if you suddenly can't speak or are saying weird words instead of the words you meant to, key sign that something's gone on.
So it's not that something is painful so much as just these behaviors are not in control of your body anymore.
So as scary as it is, some people who have a stroke aren't aware that they're having it at the time. I do know that some people have symptoms like a headache or things like that, but the key way to know that that's not just a headache, it's something else, is by these other symptoms, which is things that the brain normally does that it suddenly stops doing, particularly on one side of the body.
Most of us feel that we know someone who's had a stroke. How common is it in the population?
Really common. So I think the statistic varies a bit based on like demographics, but I think the general thing is that about 1 in 3 adults at some point in time will have a stroke, which is a lot. And one thing I can tell you too, from having looked at a lot of brain scans from people who have had strokes, is lots of people have little strokes and don't know they've had little strokes. So it's really common. It's really important to know the warning signs of it, because it's time is important. The best thing you can do for someone who's had a stroke or is having a stroke is to get them to the hospital as soon as possible.
And are there things that make someone more susceptible to this happening?
So pretty much everything that is good for general health is good for brain health. So one of the key risk factors for stroke are things like high blood pressure. And so exercise is good for reducing the risk of stroke. Healthy diet is as well. But amongst all these other things, there's also genetic risk factors. So if you are because of genetics, have bigger blood clots than other people, you're more likely to have a stroke. Or if you have thinner blood vessels. Or sometimes it's just because the way the blood vessels are laid out in the brain. So when blood travels through the blood vessels, it works like any other liquid where it hits certain points. And if you have like a sharp right angle and blood is hitting someplace for your whole life, it can wear through at that point. So that's one of the reasons it tends to happen when you're older as well, because when you're older, your blood vessels start getting worn down.
Why is it called a stroke?
I don't actually know. A lot of medical conditions are named the way that they are because when they were first discovered, someone thought, oh, this looks like this something else. So for example, cells are called cells because the guy who discovered them looked at them and thought they looked like monks' rooms and said, really? Oh, it's in, which were called cells. And so that's why they're called that. There's a bit of the brain that's called the hippocampus because it looks a little bit like a seahorse. And I think hippocampus is Greek for seahorse. So something like that would be my guess.
How can you determine which parts of the brain have been damaged by a stroke? You said it could happen in the right side or the left side. It can happen in different parts. How can scientists tell where exactly it's happened?
Luckily, you can normally see it on brain imaging. And if you're a medical doctor, if you're trying to figure out where generally was the stroke, was it big or small, things like a CT scan or an MRI scan will be enough that you can see the damage and know what's going on. On a CT scan, the brain is gray and white. And there's a very specific pattern of that gray and white that corresponds to all the different folds in the brain and all the different sub areas in the middle. And strokes disrupt that pattern. So what it will look like is on a CT scan, it'll look like an area of gray or black starts forming in one area. And when that's really new after your stroke, it's really fuzzy and it's really hard to see. But once you get about a week or so afterwards, it's really obvious because that is when the cells have been taken away and replaced by cerebral spinal fluid. And then it will just look like a big black hole.
What about before the advent of CT scans and the like? Was there ways to tell?
You could generally get a pretty good idea of where a stroke has been based on the symptoms. If you have motor weakness on one side, that tells you the stroke has been on the opposite side. If you have vision problems, that tells you that the stroke is probably in the back of your brain. Or if you have problems with inhibition and self-control and personality changes, that tells you it's been at the front of your brain.
There are some famous case studies in medical history about this. Tell me about a few of those.
So one of the really classic ones about the front of the brain stuff I just mentioned is the case of Phineas Gage. And Phineas Gage was a railway worker in the U.S., I think in like the 1800s. And he was patting something down in the hole with a stick. There was an explosion and the stick went into his brain. So it went through the front of his brain, like through an eye. And he was pretty much fine. Like he was able to walk.
What?
He was able. Yeah, this is the weird bit.
He survived that.
Yeah, he survived. He went back to work. But the problem was that he had dramatic personality changes. And so his personality was described as being really childlike. He was really difficult to work with because he was immature. He would do whatever he wanted and like just didn't follow rules anymore like a child would. And that was one of the first studies that let people know that, hey, the front of the brain is probably what's doing the you bit, the personality bit.
A higher order sort of functioning.
Yep. And then now with modern methods, we can dig into that in a lot more detail.
What about a patient who had issues around what words they could say
yes.
or couldn't say?
Yes. So one of the, I think probably like the first classical neuropsychological case study was done by Paul Broca and patient Tan. And this patient was called patient Tan because Paul Broca found this person and the only word they could say was Tan. You ask them a question, they would respond, but only say Tan. And that is a kind of aphasia, which is really common after a stroke. And this was one of the first studies that let you know that, hey, the left hemisphere is probably what's doing language. Because what they did is they didn't have neuroimaging then, so they waited for patient Tan to die, and then they took out his brain, and they looked at the brain and found that there was a big hole on the left side. And so that was one of the first things that let you know that that area is probably doing language. That is something that happens reasonably commonly after stroke. So I worked with a patient once who could only say yes, which was a little confusing.
Were they aware that they weren't yes. being able to express themselves? Yes.
Yes. So in good news, though, a lot of times these problems are to do with speech. They're not with understanding. And so you can still communicate with these people if you just don't use speech. So I was able to communicate with this person by like writing things down, saying, do you want this or this? And having them point to it instead. So oftentimes the language problems you have with stroke aren't comprehension, they aren't understanding, they're just coordinating the motor movements necessary to make your mouth turn thoughts into words.
When you were working with stroke patients in Oxford as part of your PhD, what were the wards like?
So I was working on the John Radcliffe Hospital's hyperacute stroke ward, and I did that for 3 years during my PhD. And hyperacute stroke wards are designed for people right after they've had their stroke. So there, you had your stroke. This is when you're getting immediate medical treatment. Once you're at a point where you're stable, you go to a different hospital or a different ward. And my job on that ward was to run some standard tests to try to figure out what cognitive problems people are having after stroke. So things like motor weakness and whether or not you die are kind of like a medical problem. That is the medical doctor's job. But after that, you can also get all these other things I've been talking about, like problems speaking, problems seeing, problems thinking. And that is what I looked for. So you get out of the hospital, you're medically fine, but you've got a big recovery to go. And those are the kind of things that we're interested in studying. So I would go around the wards and I would test everyone I could to try to get an idea of what they were having trouble with. And I would pass that information on to the medical doctors. And I would also use that to recruit people for some of the studies that we do.
Were they mainly older patients, Margaret?
Mainly, but not always. So average age for a stroke, I think, is around 70. But you do get lots of younger strokes as well. And so I think the youngest patient I worked with was 18. And I saw a couple like early 20s. So it can happen younger.
And what was the focus of your research with those stroke patients for your PhD?
So when I started off in my PhD, I was doing a lot of research on neglect and different conditions related to neglect. And what neglect is a really common post-stroke cognitive impairment in which people have trouble paying attention to one side of space. So what this will look like is you'll see a person who will not respond to anything on one side. They'll only eat food off of one side of their plate, only shave one side of their face. They won't pay attention to you if you walk up from the wrong side. The visual bits of the brain are fine in those people. They don't have any visual problems. What they have is an attention problem, which is about how they decide which information is worth being aware of. And so this is quite interesting to us because it shows there's a difference between vision and perception, which is the experience of vision. And this kind of helps us see what gets through, what doesn't. And neglect causes, as you can imagine, all sorts of problems in daily life. So people have trouble driving because they can't see things on one side of space, or they have trouble going about their daily lives. But also it's quite common for people to have trouble reading. And when you have neglect-like symptoms when you're reading, so leaving words off or leaving bits of words off, that's called neglect dyslexia. And that is what I did a lot of my PhD research on. And what I was really interested in is that in the literature, there are some cases of neglect dyslexia which look a bit weird. They don't behave exactly how you would expect them to behave if they were caused by neglect. So a lot of my research was looking into, what about these cases? Why sometimes this looks like neglect but isn't neglect? Is it actually something to do with this other condition, or is it its own condition? And what I found is that some of these cases of neglect dyslexia cannot be explained by neglect. Something else is going on. And a lot of my research was on, what is that something else? And what bits of the brain are doing that?
And did you find the answer to what else was going on?
I made some progress. So this is, again, very slow research because this is case study work, which means I am interested in neglect dyslexia, but I have to wait until I find someone with this problem to do research. And I was interested in a very specific subtype of neglect dyslexia, which is very, very rare. And I found three patients with that over the course of 3 years. And so what I did is I wrote three case studies where I did tons of experiments with each of these people to try to figure out what was causing their problems. And over the course of those three case studies, I completely changed my mind about what I thought was going on. At first, I thought it was some kind of neglect that's not affecting your vision, but it's affecting how you represent space about the world. So kind of your like mental dictionary of words has a problem with left versus right. Then eventually I got on and realized, hang on, this is happening in people with neglect in the opposite direction. So you have a reading problem on the right, but neglect on the left. That doesn't make sense. And I dug into why that is. And I found two of those people. And I found that what it does look like is it's something to do with inhibition or your ability to like kind of fill in the gaps. So when you as a healthy, normal reader read, you don't sound out individual letters. What you do is you see a word, you sit based on context, based on word shape, you rely on your knowledge or your predictions about what that word is to fill in the gap. And I think that process was what was going wrong. So I think in these people, what they were doing is they were seeing part of the words. They were seeing the first couple letters or the last couple letters. And then based on that, just thinking, ah, I know that word, and filling it in, but filling it in wrong. So what I would do is I'd show people words on the center of the screen and say, hey, read this word. So if I would show carrot, if you had right neglectdyslexia, you would say something like car or carriage. So you're getting the first bit, but not the last bit. And if you have left neglectdyslexia, it's the other way around. And so you'd say rot.
And what about if you wrote the word vertically rather than horizontally?
So this is one of the key tests I do to figure out what kind of neglectdyslexia it is. So the kind of neglectdyslexia, which is just caused by neglect or just caused by vision, exclusively impacts the left or right side of space. So one of the tests we do where we flip words and we present them in a line down the middle of the screen, so there's no left-right differences. If your disorder is caused by neglect or by a vision problem, you would be expected to read normally. What I found is that my patients were still making errors in that case, and they were affecting the same letter of the words as they did. So what that told me is that it's not about space. It's about where these letters are within the words.
Sherlock Holmes would be proud of you, Margot. Oh. So the wider experience of what is called neglect, where a stroke patient mm-hmm. just sees one side rather than the other, how common is that?
Really common, very common. So in my research, when I was seeing people on the wards, this is one of the things we looked for, and I found about 30% of people who'd had a stroke had that problem. Neglect is usually a happy story. Neglect can recover very quickly. So the statistic is that about 60% of neglect recovers within the first 10 days following stroke. And so lots of people have it right after they had the stroke, but if you look at it later, it's gone. And over the first 6 months following stroke, about 80% recovers.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. Conversations with Sarah Konoski.
Margaret, back when you were in Oxford working on your PhD, you got a phone call from your mum. And what made that call unusual?
Wrong time of day. If you've lived in a different time zone from your family, you know that there are times when calls happen and times when calls do not happen. And I got a call, I think it was for me, like probably around noon on a Tuesday. And that is not a normal time to get a call.
So you were aware straight away that something was up.
That seemed abnormal to me. But I thought, oh, I'm just being anxious. It's probably fine. And picked up the phone, very ready to talk.
And what did your mom tell you?
My dad had a stroke during my PhD. Quite a bad stroke, quite sudden. So my dad was 56 at the time. And I got a call from my mom saying that he had collapsed while making coffee in the morning. Said he woke up with a bad headache, went out to make coffee, and collapsed in the kitchen. And she described what he was experiencing, and that was a stroke.
And of course, she would have been calling you as the daughter who is away from home to let you know. But were you also a bit of a stroke expert that she was hoping would clarify what was going on?
This was an experience that made me realize, like, how the kind of expertise I have is good in some situations, not that helpful in other situations. I could describe what was happening. I could say that's a stroke. I could guess what part of the brain had been affected, but I knew very little about what to do besides saying, get to the hospital as soon as possible. So with strokes, time is really important because the longer bits of the brain go without oxygen, the more cells die. And so speed is an important thing if you think someone's had a stroke.
And what can they do in hospital to, you know, if that's already happening, what happens in the hospital?
Sometimes you have strokes that happen because a blood vessel is burst. There's not much you can do about those. But the other kind, which is more common, where a blood vessel is clogged, there's lots of things you can do to try to break up that clot. So you can use blood thinners, which is why people prescribe aspirin to people who are at risk. That thins your blood a little bit. Or you can do something fancier called mechanical thrombectomy, where you can go in with kind of like a robotic surgery thing to grab the clot and take it out. So there's different treatment pathways depending on what's caused the stroke.
But you knew that it was important that your mum and dad get to hospital as soon as they could. And what about you? How long did it take for you to travel from England back home to Indiana?
So this was mid-COVID. This was, I think, early 2021. And by a while, I mean, it took me, like, I think, 3 or 4 days to get back. And that was as fast as it could be.
And when you got home to America, who came and got you at the airport?
My brothers drove to Chicago to come pick me up, which was really nice.
That must have been a hard car ride, though.
It's still one of those things that's kind of seared in your brain as like an experience, because it feels like kind of a calm before the storm moment. Because at that point, we knew that it wasn't good. So on the first day after he got to the hospital, my mom took a picture of his brain scan and sent it to me, I think hoping that I could be like, I'll fix it. It was really very bad, and you could see that right away. And it's something that kind of from that point, we knew that either he wasn't going to make it, or that if he did make it, he wouldn't be himself anymore. And so it had felt kind of like we'd already lost him. And I think on that ride, it was being like us, my brothers and I, just appreciating each other's company and kind of treasuring this, knowing that we're going into this, whoever knows how long, of like making these big decisions and having our last bit of time with our dad.
Was your dad able to hear you or speak to you at all when you saw him in the hospital?
So he was able to speak right after he'd had a stroke. So I got to talk to him for like 30 seconds before he went into surgery and got flown to a different hospital. And he was very nonchalant about all of it. He said like, oh, I'll be fine. Don't be worried about me. He seemed like upset that we were worried about it. But like we knew it was a lot worse than he knew it was. But by the time I got there, he was unconscious and on sedatives so that he didn't move, because he had quite a bad hemorrhage. So the kind of stroke where a blood vessel bursts. And when that happens, sometimes the brain can swell. And so to do that, you do some surgery where you take off a bit of the skull so that the brain can swell without damaging itself more. And it's really important that you do not move a lot. And so they kept him sedated during a lot of that to make sure that he didn't wake up and start messing with important things.
What decision did you and your mum and brothers have to make as your situation with your dad got clearer?
One good thing is that my parents were like over planners. And so they had like a will and like instructions for these kind of things written out years ago. I think when they were like 40, they had this all planned out. And that took a lot of the burden off of us, because we knew things like, we knew that my dad didn't want us to just keep him alive using life support if he wasn't going to be able to be himself. And we also knew that he wanted to be an organ donor. And because he was young, it was going out in this quick way, he was eligible to donate things like your lungs, which are pretty important. And so we did a lot of trying to see if we could get him set up for that. And that was hard, because that ultimately meant taking him off life support earlier than he could have been. But based on all these things he'd written in the past, we knew that this is what he wanted to happen. So it was hard to make, but I feel very confident that that is what he wanted to do, which made it a lot easier. Mm. And that whole process, it took about a week to figure out that he was definitely wasn't going to make it, and that we could try to do what we could during this time. And so we tried to organize organ donation, and that was such a mess, because you go into the surgery, you take him off life support, and you can only harvest organs when people have died within a certain range, because if you have low oxygen for long periods of time, that damages the organs. So he went into the surgery, and not all of us could go in with him. And so my mom and my older brother went in, and my younger brother and I waited outside for hours. Then we had to take him out of this surgery and move him into hospice and just wait for him to die naturally. But like back and forth of that was like brutal. Honestly, from never having experienced a kind of loss like this, I'm always surprised by how grief is. It doesn't seem like it should be this way from the outside. So I'm normally very fine talking about this, because this is something that has happened to me. It's fine. But when you feel the emotion of it, it just random, completely unrelated times. And it's really annoying. One of the things I do is I have my dad's wedding band that I wear with me. And every once in a while, I'll like be doing something cool. I'll be on a hike and I'll be like doing something excited. And I'll look down and think like, oh, like I wish I could tell him about this. And then I cry. And so it's very weird to process. But also I think that in a way, the experience has been pretty freeing, because it's really reframed what's important to me. This happened to me right when I was writing my PhD, when I was applying for grants, when I was getting ready to move to Australia. And just going through something that was that stressful and that bad made everything else seem pretty fine in comparison. So I wasn't that stressed about getting rejected from grants. So it would be fine. And like that bit was, that's something I didn't anticipate happening. But that kind of really reframed what I'm able to be upset about.
The fact that your dad died from stroke as you were in the midst of writing up your PhD about strokes Did that fire you even further into the research that you do, or what?
It was, again, a weird combination of emotions, because one of the emotions I felt most clearly during this whole process is feeling really useless. Like, it doesn't really matter if I can know exactly how to figure out which area of the brains are damaged and can do complicated math to figure out what that area was doing in the first place. There's really nothing I can do. I couldn't do anything in that time to actually be helpful. And what this made me realize is that if I'm doing this research, I need to be doing it because I love it. And I think it's fun and it's a good challenge and I like the problem solving of it. And I need to not be motivated by helping other people, as terrible as that sounds, because I would love to be helpful to people. But if that is the only thing I got value from, I wouldn't be able to do this kind of research.
Because it's just, what, such a long lead time between your research in the lab and what happens on a ward.
Everything that I do at best is the tiniest, tiniest step in the right direction. And so it's just really reframed my motivations. It made me feel okay about being motivated by the theory of the research rather than the helping people bit of it. Because I would love to help people, but I think that, like, where I help people isn't going to be my research. It's going to be me talking to them about what a stroke is and why you're having these problems and what you can expect during recovery.
Well, given your dad's obvious love of learning and his deep curiosity, I think he'd probably approve.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
So what brought you to Australia? In terms of where your career was going, why did you come here?
So I wanted to come here because I knew of a professor here. So Professor Jason Mattingly, who's also at QBI.
Who's the Queensland Brain Institute.
Yes. Yeah. He was a nice person and does really interesting research.
Tick,
and
tick.
Yes, I'm very motivated by working for nice people because academia is so collaborative. Having a boss you don't like or someone who doesn't let you work in the way that you want to work is going to make things terrible. But Jason has a neuropsychology background, but works in cognitive neuroscience. And so these are methods that I had never used before I came here. And so it was a really good opportunity for me to learn some new techniques, get good at some new skills, then hopefully still bring that back to working with patients at some point.
So what's your day-to-day research involve here?
Lots of chaos. And so these things never happen all in a nice little line. And so normally you have lots of different projects you're working on at lots of different stages. And so some of the things I do are data collection. And so right now I'm working with an honors student who we've designed a project for him. I'm teaching him how to do these different neuroimaging methods and we're collecting data. A lot of my work is analysis. So what that means is I stare at my computer and write code to look at brain data in interesting ways. And then you also write these findings up. So once I'm convinced my analysis is good, I make some pretty figures and I write an argument about why I think it's interesting and try to get that published. I do a lot of like supervising students and things like that and trying to help them learn these skills as well.
One of the research areas that you're collecting data on and writing papers around is what you call the brain's autocorrect. You referred to that before, but explain that more for me. Draw that out. What does it mean?
What this is called is the theory is called predictive coding. And what this means is that a lot of how you experience the world is determined by how you expect to experience the world. And the reason we need this is that the brain has an enormous amount of information coming at it. If you had to process all of that information, that would be very metabolically expensive, which just means you would have to burn tons of calories to do that. Every time you take something from incoming information to something you feel and experience, that is cells doing things which require energy. So ideally, you want to set up a system in which you can get the most important information while burning the least amount of calories. A good example of this is the brain tunes out things that aren't important. So how your clothes feel on your body is some information you are always getting, but your brain knows it's not important. Let's not pay attention to it. And that's one way the brain is efficient, by only paying attention to and processing things that are relevant to you. Another way it does this is by predictive coding. And so what this means is that every time you experience something in the world, it's a combination between new sensory input and then expectations about what you expected that to be. So for example, things like you have predictions. I expect to look up and see you. If you suddenly weren't there, that would be a prediction violation, and I would really pay attention to that and invest a lot of resources to try to figure out what's going wrong. And so that's one example of just how when things violate those predictions are when they get extra attention. And so that's your brain highlighting, whoa, that wasn't what we expected. Let's look at that, process it really heavily, and figure out what's going on.
So how can stroke fit in this? What happens when someone has a stroke?
So because prediction is such a fundamental way of how we see and understand the world, when you have damage to the brain, it can also damage those processes. It's very probable that some of those have to do with a disorder of prediction. So I talked about neglect earlier, in which people are getting all the visual information, but you're not paying attention to one side of space. And one possibility is that maybe you're not paying attention because your predictive models of the world are saying important information is only over here and nowhere else. And so that's kind of imbalance in your predictions and inability to update those predictions based on new information. And so the idea is that lots of conditions might be caused by disorders of prediction because it filters how we see the world, how we experience the world, what we pay attention to, what gets flagged as, hey, you should look over there now, is all because of us predicting what comes next.
So your focus is on understanding if that's happening or analyzing how that's happening. How might that get applied clinically somewhere down the line?
We're pretty far off from that. The main motivation for the kind of things I do in healthy people is to try to understand to what extent prediction biases how we see the world. So in healthy people, I do a lot of showing them objects and seeing how the brain responds when that was a surprising duck versus an expected duck and things like that.
Tell me more about, just give me a sense of those exercises.
So this is something, if you participate in one of my studies, what you will do is you will come in and you will stare at a cross on the screen while we record brain activity. And what we do is we flash images up really quickly and we're always playing some tricks. So what we do is we manipulate what kind of predictive information you have. So for example, one of the studies we're working on now is we have a series of images which are all plants. So you have a tree, a bush, a flower, then all of a sudden you'll have a duck. And then you go back to trees, bushes, and flowers, and we try to see how does the brain respond to that duck when you have a prediction of it's probably going to be a plant. And what we do is actually, it sounds cool, but what it is this technique called neural decoding. And what we do is we try to figure out what people were seeing on the screen just by looking at brain activity. So it's a machine learning technique. You try to train models to figure out what brain activity pattern corresponds to duck and when the duck is just random. And then once you've got that model, you can say, all right, I can predict if it was a duck or not with like 70% accuracy. How does that accuracy change when the duck is surprising versus not surprising? So it's a way of figuring out how information about the world is represented in brain activity and then comparing how do those patterns change under different conditions. Mm. It's very popular now in cognitive neuroscience.
So if someone is seeing tree, 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 and then a duck appears, are different parts of the brain lighting up, or is the fact that because they're both responding to visual stimuli, so presumably that's the part of the brain that's lighting up. Is there something when there's a change, does something else happen up there? What are you seeing?
So most of the techniques we're looking for now aren't looking at what areas of the brain, but we're looking at brain activity. And so what this looks like is the brain responds to stimuli with little spikes in electrical activity over time. And most of those spikes for visual stimuli are going to come from the back of the brain. But what this means is that sometimes those spikes are bigger than other times, or sometimes they're noisier, or sometimes you have two overlapping with each other when you would only have one. So it's kind of looking at the pattern of spiking activity over the entire brain. And so visual information comes from the back of the brain, but in theory, we can detect things in the front of the brain too, if that helps us figure out that information too. So we're not looking for where in the brain, we're looking for to what degree is information represented. Is it represented well? Is it noisy? Is it completely different in one condition versus another condition?
What would you predict scientifically might be happening with someone if someone had had a brain affected by a stroke and you were doing a similar activity with them?
So one thing I'm really interested in is right now I look at how both brain hemispheres respond in healthy people. One thing that's happening in stroke is one brain hemisphere is not going to be doing the same thing as the other brain hemisphere. So there's quite a lot of potential of showing things to different brain hemispheres and comparing within people how each one is responding. And so I would love to do something like this, seeing if people are picking up on these patterns, but seeing if where in space it is determines what information is getting identified as being a prediction versus not identified. But I'm working on that slowly. I've just started recruiting some stroke patient volunteers for that. One of the things that draws me to this is because I am a neuropsychologist by background, which means I study brain damage and behavior. This is more of a cognitive neuroscience question, which is a kind of a new field, but I've really been enjoying it because, again, it's a model that makes very clear predictions about how things should work and how things shouldn't work. And I think it's a really great thing to try to test. So a lot of my research is trying to poke at that model, saying, ah, but what is exactly is a prediction? When you have a duck, when you expect a duck, are you expecting a shape? Are you expecting a color? Are you expecting something that swims? Or like, what level of information is being predicted? What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to see is, does this theory hold up to lots of different tests? And then we'll know what's going on, maybe.
Margaret, you have referred to the fact that stroke victims can really vary in their recovery. And that's one of the most challenging things, I think, for people who've had a stroke or their loved ones is not knowing, because sometimes people can recover enormous amounts of speech and movement, and sometimes people are really, really changed and suffer a lot of disability after a stroke. What are the indications that someone will make a good recovery? Can you tell from early on?
So this is a whole field of research. There are some things which predict good recovery and some things which predict bad recovery, but it's complicated. So in stroke, sometimes people have a stroke, then recover and they're fine right away. Sometimes people have a stroke, kind of just stay the same forever. And then sometimes people have a stroke and then have another stroke and then get dementia and then just kind of go on this downwards pathway. And a lot of what Nayla's research is trying to figure out what determine who goes on these pathways. And one of the key things we found that helps separate between people who do recover and don't recover is cognition. Like, do you have a language problem? Yes, no. Do you have trouble looking at different areas of space? Yes, no. That kind of stuff does the best job of predicting who goes into which of those bins of anything else I've tried. And so just simple behavioral tests after you've had a stroke provide a really good measure of who's going to recover and who won't. And a lot of that is based off of some disorders are going to recover better than others.
Which ones tend to?
So just because how the brain works, some brain areas can pick up new things. Some brain areas, when they're damaged, nowhere else in the brain can pick up those functions. So a good example of areas that can recover are lots of things like motor function. So moving your arms, because there's quite a big area of the brain that deals with moving different parts of the body. If one area goes away, the other areas can gradually readjust and pick up that function. A counterexample is something that doesn't recover very well is vision. And that's because vision, especially at the early level, is dependent on a bit of the brain which is structured in a way that no other bit of the brain is. So the early visual cortex has like many different layers of cells that process information leading from like angles of lines to contrast to shape. And there's not really anywhere else in the brain that can do that. So if you have a vision problem, it's not as likely to recover.
So if the damage happens in a part of the brain that is widespread, say, with movement, so that if the damage is localized in one area, but there are other parts of the brain that might be able to help with movement, how is that recovery aided? How are patients supported to use other parts of their brain, say, to develop movement?
The brain operates on trying to be as efficient as possible. If you want your brain to learn new things, you have to convince it that that is an important skill you need to learn. And so just trying to using the skill you've lost as often as possible. So anything like moving your hands around, doing physical rehabilitation, anything that makes you use that skill is going to train your brain to be, hey, that is important, we should bring this back. So as annoying as it is, like, practice is the best thing to do. Same with like anything, like learning a musical instrument, you just need to convince your brain that this is a skill it needs to use. Stroke recovery is pretty much based off of neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change, to take up new skills or learn new things. And some people are going to have a greater ability to recover because of having like more capacity for that. And that can be something like if you are younger, your brain is younger, you have more cells, you have more connections, you can take up more things. If you're older, you might not have as big a recovery capability because you might have, your brain might not be as healthy as it once used to be. One of the things I really care about is trying to do these predictions in a simple and practical way. And so what this means is that I've done a couple projects trying to predict who's going to recover and who's not going to recover based on patterns of lesion damage. This stuff is complicated. This is me having 900 patients who have all had damage, mapping that damage to which brain networks are affected, using machine learning to see which networks predict who's going to do a good job and not do a good job during recovery. And I can do all of that. It does predict it, but it does not predict it as well as cognition does. So this is something I'm really keen about, is that simple things are often really helpful, like simple things that like the doctors will have available to them. Anyone can run these cognitive tests, do a much better job than a lot of us data nerds can do. And I think that's very powerful to say that like there's all this simple, accessible, and practical information out there that can help inform recovery. How we structure these studies is we have people who are tested right after they have their stroke. We have information like, how big was your stroke? How old were you? Did you have any other conditions? And then we have a lot of cognitive information. So we have, how did they do on these 8 different tasks? We test them again 6 months or 2 years later to try to see how did they do on all those things again at that point. And then we have also information like, did they have another stroke? Yes or no. Did the person die? Yes or no. And what we try to do is we try to use data we collected at that first time point to predict where people are going to be at that second time point. Because ideally, we want to find information that doctors can use to guess who isn't going to do well, so that future rehabilitation techniques can target those people. So everyone should get rehab, but it's just a way of maybe we can flag who needs more help.
You're so deep in the study of the brain, Margaret. Like it's this great source of curiosity and interest for you, but you've also got your own brain.
Yeah.
Like, how do you think about that thing inside your skull? Does it feel like the core of who you are, or is it, you know, an interesting research subject? Or what do you make of your own brain?
It feels like a weird little jellyfish that, like, sometimes I can tell it what to do and sometimes it's just going to do its own thing anyways. And so it's kind of really interesting to me because spending this much time studying things like attention and memory makes you realize that your experience of the world is so biased. You only remember things the way you think you remember them. The world seems 100% right to you, but it's like all these things are biased. It makes me question myself maybe a lot more than I should. But yeah, I am like constantly amazed by that, like, basic functions that, like, oh, I can see that, or oh, I recognize that my cat was hiding there. It makes me feel constantly amazed by the fact that, like, this is my experience of the world and it's all being done by a bunch of weird cells in my head.
And not trusting your assumptions as much.
Yeah. I think when I first started studying these kind of things, it was a lot of feeling really smart. It was a lot of like, wow, look at me. I'm doing complicated analyses. I know machine learning. It's great. And the farther you get in, the more you realize, like, I'm spending my life on this. I can, like, do these things okay. But, like, everything is dependent on these processes. And so it's very unsettling to realize how uncertain we are about a lot of what's going on under the surface. I kind of find it exciting because I find that there's so much more that needs to be figured out and worked on.
I think we could all do with a big dose of uncertainty.
Yeah.
So it sounds good to me. Thank you so much for sharing some of your research with us on Conversations.
No worries.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
As Conversations fans, you love a fascinating character, and there are plenty in this story. Spies, lies, and deception in an outback Australian town. The country's most secretive spy base is hidden on the fringe of Alice Springs. It's shaped a town, transformed war, and continues to expand.
Pine Gap is almost certainly a prime nuclear target.
Come with me, Alex Barwick, to find out what on earth is happening in my backyard.
Why are there secrets that we shouldn't know? What are they?
Spies in the Outback. Check it out and subscribe on the ABC Listen app.